So today's an exciting day. I want to demonstrate the isoparametric inequality. So my thesis advisor taught a class on this back when I was a grad student at MIT, and it was one of the things that kind of blew my mind and attracted me to study with him for at MIT and get my PhD with him. So he taught a class on Fourier analysis there. He was a student of Eli Stein, and that was before Eli Stein wrote this book. Anyway, this is the beginning of chapter 4 in Stein's book. And let me tell you what the isoparametric inequality is in the plane. There's isoparametric inequalities of lots of different kinds in lots of different settings. But the most basic one is the fact that the circle encloses the most area possible. If you give me a rope of length L and I try to enclose an area with it, the circle is the one that's going to enclose the biggest area. So if you think about it, let's think of the circle case. Let's say that the perimeter, the perimeter of that, the length of that curve is going to be, let's say, L. And then let's see, if I had a circle, the area of a circle would be A equals pi r squared, and the circumference of a circle is 2 pi r. So in this case, L would be equal to 2 pi r. And so let's see, if I want to get a formula between the area and the length of the rope, then I would solve this for r and get L is equal to L over 2 pi. And then I would have A equals pi times the radius squared would be L over 2 pi squared. And I get that in the case of a circle, the area is what? L squared over 4 pi. That's the circle. And so the deal is, anything that's not a circle, if I push my rope in and bump it or deform it, that area is going to get strictly bigger. And this is an equality exactly in the case of a circle. And so the isoparametric inequality is, for a non-circle, the area is strictly less than L squared over 4 pi. You only get equality in the case of the circle. So that's the isoparametric inequality. And you know, you learned about maxes and mins in calculus. This is a new kind of problem where we want to maximize the area over all possible curves. That's a problem in the calculus of variations. So and it's a fantastic subject, the calculus of variations. And if you think about, well, my delta x now is not a little delta x, it's a change in the curve. So I can do things like take like difference quotients where I deform my curve a little bit and let that deformation go to zero and play games like that. You get a lot of very fantastic classical math by playing that kind of games. But the mind-blowing proof I'm going to give to you today is a very short and sweet proof based on Parseval's identity that we know. And so it's going to be beautiful and nice. Before I do that, I need to talk about a couple consequences of Parseval's. Identity. So remember, let's do Fourier series on interval from minus pi to pi. Remember, the Parseval's identity said that the sum of the Fourier coefficients modulus squared is equal to, this would be minus infinity to plus infinity, is equal to 1 over 2 pi, the integral from minus pi to pi of the modulus of f squared d, let's do dt. maybe I should use Stein's notation here, that the Cn is F hat n. So that was the Parseval identity. A consequence of Parseval's identity, if I take a G and inner product it with an F, then you get that this second formula, the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity, I'll take the Fourier coefficients of F and dot product them with the Fourier coefficients for G. And I got to take a conjugate right there. That's equal to 1 over 2 pi times the inner product from minus pi to pi of f of t, g of t conjugate, dt. Whenever you have this one automatically. It's called the polarization identity that you can actually write down the inner product in terms of L2 norms. But this is an interesting thing, is that this, if you take F and send, okay, I'm going to explain why this inner product is true. If I inner product, let's write F, we know, is equal to, let's take the sum from minus n to n of fn e to the int plus a remainder. Let's call this thing f sub n. And this thing is a remainder. And if I take enough of these things, the L2 norm of this remainder is going to be small. So if you think of the L2 norm of the remainder squared, that's the tail end of the series. Let's see, it would be equal to 1 over 2 pi times the sum of absolute n bigger than n of those coefficients squared. That's the tail end of a convergent series, so this goes to zero. And the Bessel's inequality said that series converges, and that's the tail end of it, so I can assume this goes to zero in L2 as n goes to infinity. So when I inner product F with G and write it like this, this is the easy part to do that inner product and see that I get the what I expect to get. So next when I do this, I would get F inner producted with G equals F plus FN plus the RF, the remainder, inner product with GN plus the remainder of G. And the R, let's see, when I write these out, I would get Fn with Gn. That's the one that's easy to calculate. Because of orthogonality and the fact that these are finite sums, this spits out exactly what I expect to get. And the rest of the stuff I'm going to show goes to zero, plus stuff that goes to zero. Do I need to write it out? In L2. And so I get the, and this one is what I wanted to see it. This is, this by orthogonality is the sum from minus n to n of f hat n with g hat n. And so the rest of the stuff you just estimate and show that it goes to zero. By the way, the estimate I would use there is called the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. And there's two versions of it. Namely, this version would be a summation of numbers, a n, b n conjugate. Take any range you want, is less than or equal to the sum of a n squared to the 1/2 times the summation of b n squared modulus squared to the 1/2. That's Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. It's true for finite, and it would be true for infinite sums too. And another Cauchy-Schwarz inequality is that the integral from minus pi to pi of f of t g conjugate of t dt is less than or equal to the L2 norm to the 1/2 times the L2 norm of g to the 1/2. And the property of mapping a function to its Fourier coefficients, it shows you that L2 of functions is isomorphic to little L2 of sequences. So Fourier series is all about doing this. Namely that when I take a function and I send it to its Fourier series, that's a sequence of numbers. That maps functions L2 from minus pi to pi, and it gives an isomorphism to something called little L2, namely the square summable sequences. And this is an inner product space, and this is an inner product space, and the Fourier series makes them isomorphic. In fact, isometric. The Parseval's inequality shows you that the norms get preserved, and the inner product gets preserved. Okay, that's really all I need today to do the isoparametric inequality. So that's the preliminary stuff. Let's... Here's the proof of the isoparametric inequality. I'm going to make a simplifying assumption that the length of my rope, so length of my perimeter rope, assume that the length of gamma equals L is equal to 2 pi. So I'm thinking of a circle of radius 1.
Just a quick thing about the isomorphism. What's the notion of isomorphism for
in Hilbert spaces? It's going to be that it's a linear one-to-one onto map that preserves the norm and preserves the inner product. And Parseval's is exactly what shows that it preserves the norm and preserves the inner product. Modulo dividing by a 1 over 2 pi annoyance. Okay, so we want to show that the area, is less than or equal to pi. That'll be equivalent to the general case because I can always scale it. If I can prove it for this case, I can scale it to any other length and I'll have the fact for that length. So this is equivalent to what I want to show. And here's a fantastic thing. You know, you learned Green's theorem someplace. Oh, I usually change my pen to green when I write Green's theorem. Green's theorem says I integrate, so here's my curve gamma, and let's say it bounds a region omega. Green's theorem says the integral around gamma of p dx plus q dy equals the integral over the region of dq dx minus dp dy with respect to area, dx dy. Okay, here's a very clever thing to do. You want to estimate the area by an integral over the boundary. Okay, so here's the brilliant idea. I can pick easy functions to make this be 1. Let's say if I pick q to be x, then dq dx would be 1. And if I pick p to be minus y, then I'd get minus minus 1, so I'd get 2. So the brilliant idea here is let's let q equal x and p equal minus y. When I do that, I get the integral around gamma of minus y dx plus x dy equals 2, it would be the integral of 2. So I'd get the integral around omega 2 times 1 d area, and that would be 2 times the area of my region. And now another important step is I'm going to parametrize my curve by arc length. And I'll be able to calculate this integral pretty in a very straightforward way. An important step that's going to make this all work. Let's see, I'm going to need this thing. An important step, I want to parametrize gamma by arc length. And I'll call my arc length t. Okay, so my gamma is going to be given by in parametric form by x of t and y of t. And t is arc length. And I'm going to express this as a Fourier series. This would be a sum of x hat n e to the int. I'm going to assume my curve is C2 smooth, so I know these Fourier series converge nicely in that case. So this would be a sum from minus infinity to infinity, and this is going to be a sum from minus infinity to infinity of y hat n e to the int. And because I'm parametrizing by arc length, and my arc length is 2 pi, my t is going to range from t to 0 to 2 pi. Another important thing when you parametrize by arc length is the tangent vector has unit length. T is arc length. So, the vector x dot t times I plus y dot t times j has unit length. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that square root of x dot t squared, that kind of looks like is equal to 1. And how nice, I can square that and see that x dot t squared plus y dot t squared equals 1. 2. That's going to be important, because that's going to tell us what the L2 norm of those things are. Um, Okay, so now I'm getting somewhere. That's a parametrization of my curve. And so I know now that my area is 1/2 the integral along gamma of minus y dx plus x dy. And now that I have a parametrization, actually I don't want to parametrize like that. I want to parametrize from minus pi to pi. Just because I'm in Fourier series, that's what we've been doing. It has length 2 pi.
Why not?
Then when I parametrize this curve, this area is going to be 1/2 the integral from minus pi to pi. The y function is the y of t. And the x dx stands for x dot of t dt. And this other one is going to be plus x of t, and the dy stands for y dot of t dt. That's what that notation stands for in Green's theorem. And now, if you think Fourier series and Parseval's identity, these are inner products. So this is the exciting moment where Fourier series just pops right out. Let's see, by the way, if we know the Fourier series of x, we also know the Fourier series of x prime. So we're going to assume gamma is C2 smooth, so that my Fourier series are going to converge nicely. And not only that, but the Fourier series for my derivative is going to converge nicely. And we know, remember it was an integration by parts things, we know that x dot n is what you get when you differentiate the Fourier series, in x hat of n. Yeah, we know that. And similar for y dot. When you take the Fourier series of a derivative, it's like differentiating the Fourier series term by term. And we verified that by integrating by parts and calculating the Fourier coefficient of the derivative. It pops right out. So that's something we did. And so now when I look at this and say, aha, these are inner products, and I've got Parseval's identity, I get that A is 1/2. Let's see, remember the Parseval's is going to give me 2 pi times the sum of y hat n is going to be a minus here times where do I want to put my bar? I want my bar on the other thing. It doesn't really matter where I put the bar, but I'm going to put my bar on the y. Because these are real valued functions, so it doesn't matter where I put the bar, actually. But the bar's got to be there. So I'll put I'll have minus, what do I want? Oh, I see. I'm sorry what I'm doing here. Y. Okay. I'm looking at my notes wrong. I'll have here minus y hat n. And then my x prime is in x hat n. And I've got to take a conjugate of that to get the inner product. And this goes from minus infinity to infinity. That's from the first inner product. This inner product is x with y prime. And so that one is going to be plus x hat n times the y1, which is I n y hat n. That's the derivative. And I've got to take a conjugate of that one. Well, that looks kind of nasty. Let me clean it up a little bit. Yeah, so this is 1/2 times 2 pi times... I can pull a minus I in, a minus I out of this mess and get, well, I think I'll leave it in. 1/2 times 2 pi times the sum from minus infinity to infinity. I'll have an I n. I'll put the stuff on there, the far side first. Xn yn conjugate, and then I'll have this minus yn xn conjugate. Okay, that's an important formula, so I'll put a red line under that. Okay, next, I'm going to make note that that I know a norm. I know that the integral from minus pi to pi of x dot squared plus y dot squared dt, that would be equal to, this would be equal to 2 pi. Because remember, this thing was equal to 1. This is arc length, and so the length of my tangent vector has got to be 1. So I know that. And that's just an L2 norm. So if I use Parseval's identity, that is going to be 2 pi, let's see, this is going to be 2 pi times the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of the Fourier coefficients for x prime squared. So that's going to be minus I n x hat n squared plus the other one is the y one, and that one's going to be it's not minus IN, it's plus IN. When I square it, it doesn't matter. And this one is going to be IN Y hat N squared. That's what the thing on the left is by Parseval's. And so I know that this is equal to 2 pi. Two pi's are going to cancel. And so here's the neat thing. I want to show that a is less than or equal to pi. I'm sorry. So this, the Parseval's identity, what is the Parseval's identity? It's 1 over 2 pi times this is equal to this, right? So this is 2 pi times that. I'm going to screw this up. 2 pi. Yeah. Okay, so yes. So I'm going to write down... pi minus my area. The mind-blowing thing here is that when I write down pi minus my area, I'm going to get a sum of squares. So let me solve for pi here. Pi is equal to, I can cancel out the 2's, and I get pi is equal to pi times the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of n squared times x hat n squared plus y hat n squared. All right, so I've got pi here, I've got a here. I'm going to take pi minus a. So my a thing was underlined there. Now I'm going to underline this one. And I'm going to write pi minus a. I want to show that this is positive. Is equal to, I have a pi in front, and I've got a sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of n squared times I have a square bracket n squared times x hat n squared plus y hat n squared. Now I got to look at my thing up here. What is it? I've got a 1 half times 2 pi, so there's a pi there. 1 half times 2 pi, so I've got a pi in front of that thing. And I'll put that, I'm going to copy that mess and put it here. X and y n minus. Minus, where is it? In yn xn hat conjugate minus x hat n y hat n conjugate. And that all goes inside of a square bracket. Let me move it over. Okay, that's not fun to look at, but when you mess around with this, it's a sum of squares. So, you'd have to sit around and mess around with it for a while, but if you're trying to do calculus of variations and advanced things, and it all turns out to be algebra from here on in, then it blows your mind. So, if I were to write, I'm going to write my x hat n equals alpha n plus I beta n, and write my y hat n, I want real and imaginary parts, is an plus ibn. Then when you write all this mess out in terms of these things, let's see, these are actually conjugates of each other, aren't they? Yeah, this is a conjugate of that. So it's actually, this is actually, these are real numbers. This is something minus its conjugate. So the imaginary part, what? Something. Oh, there's an I in front. So it is going to be real when you think about it. Well, when you do this and just do the algebra, your pi minus your area is going to turn out to be, so algebra, very routine algebra, is going to give you that pi minus the area is 1 half pi Oops, there's no 1 half. Where did my 1 half go? Oh yeah, my 1 half's went away. I get pi times a sum from minus infinity to infinity, n squared, alpha n squared plus beta n squared plus a n squared plus b n squared minus 2n times beta n minus alpha n beta n. I won't bore you to death by writing that out. It's just, you just write it out and spit it all out. And the mind-blowing thing is that that is a sum of squares. And so this is going to be equal to pi times the sum from minus infinity to infinity of n alpha n plus bn. So, of course, whoever wants to prove the isoparametric inequality is desperate. So they'd sit around and look at this algebra for days and days until it hit them. But they'd definitely be famous after they realize, aha, this is a sum of squares. And so I just proved the isoparametric inequality. This pi minus a is bigger than or equal to zero. So the aha is a sum of positive terms. Well, let's see, the terms are greater than or equal to zero. And so pi minus a is strictly positive. Not strictly positive. So pi minus a is bigger than or equal to zero. And that's it. QED. That's the isoparametric inequality. But I can do more. What if I had equality here? This is a sum of positive terms. It would mean all of them have to be zero. So let's start with the last one here. N squared minus one, well, let's see, if n is bigger, two or more, that's not zero. And so if this thing is, if these are actually equal, that would imply that a n squared and b n squared both have to be zero. Okay, if I know that a n is zero, then look at this one. Then this one would show you that b n has to be zero. And if I know that b n is zero, that goes away. And this one would show me that a n, alpha n, has to be zero. So, furthermore, if pi minus a equals zero, we see that a n equals b n equals alpha n equals beta n equals zero for n equals, for n not equal to one. So let's see, one of the bad ones. The term that are going to be problematic. Where's the n equals zero term? But yeah, if n is equal to zero, this n squared minus one. I could take my center to be the origin. That would have been, let's see. N squared minus one. The constant term is probably different than that. Where did the constant term go?
Yeah, the n equals zero. I'm sorry. If you look at this thing up here,
the n equals zero term makes that go away. And so the n equals zero term, well, that goes away too. There is no n equals zero term. Right? So the n equals zero term doesn't contribute to this sum. Because if this is 0 and this is 0, it's not in there. So I don't have to worry about the n equals 0 term. It's this. So it's when n is equal to 1 where this kicks in. And that's why I have to see that that's equal to, those have to be 0 from that point on. For n equals plus or minus 2, plus or minus 3, etc. And what we're left with for n equal plus or minus 1, you can check out see, when n is equal to 1, that term goes to 0. This term would be 0 when n is equal to 1. So that those aren't there, and I'm left with those two things. And n is equal to 1. So that shows you that a1 equals beta 1. And a and bn equals minus alpha n. So in fact, what is it? It's that if you were to sit down and do it carefully, you'd find that alpha plus or minus 1 equals minus or plus b plus or minus 1. And beta plus or minus 1 equals plus or minus a plus or minus 1. And for n equals 0, we don't care. It's that those terms we don't have to worry about. They can, the a-naught and the b-naught can be anything. Because, you know, if you shift your picture, it's not going to change the area. So that's why the a-naught, the 0 terms are not relevant in that calculation. Anyway, it all boils down to this. So remember, the x was equal to its Fourier series, and I just showed you that most of its Fourier series was 0. And so what you get is that x of t is the x0 coefficient, something we don't care about. And then we get plus 2 alpha 1 cosine. When I write this in and you do the complex things and use these facts, I get this. These are all that's left when I throw away all the higher order terms, and I would get y hat 0. And because of these equalities, I'd get 2 beta 1 cosine t plus 2 alpha 1 sine t. And when you remember that exercise in Stein where you showed that this kind of thing is a cosine thing with a sine, with a phase shift. And this is going to, when you write it out and play that game, you're going to see that this is just a circle with the t not starting at the usual place. It's with a phase shift. And so this is a circle. It's going to be a circle centered at x naught, this point. And you can show that's a circle. So, it looks like maybe I got long and involved, but whenever I did any real work, it was just algebra. The fact was Parseval's equality, and the fact that some very elementary facts about Fourier series, like the derivative of Fourier series. Of course, Green's theorem is not a very trivial thing to show in a general picture like that. Have you seen? Probably haven't seen it. Real proof of Green's theorem anywhere, have you? I didn't see one until I went to graduate school, and of course I had to read it myself. So if you really wanted to nail this down and believe it 100%, you'd probably want to demonstrate Green's theorem to yourself. And my favorite place to see Green's theorem, that's sort of the most advanced thing that we haven't demonstrated in here. Green's theorem, it's proved nicely in Spivak. Calculus on Manifolds. It's a little paperback book. And he doesn't do it on manifold. Well, he does it later in the book on manifolds. First he does it in the more common situation. That's where I first saw it proved completely. There's some nice books on advanced calculus where it's done. Edwards is a nice book on it. So that's the most advanced thing to prepare you for this. By the way, if you can do it for C2 curves, well, then you can let those C2 curves deform, bulge them out, and make and reduce the smoothness assumptions. Take limits of C2 curves and see how general a thing you can get. A mind-blowing thing is when you start doing that, you want to understand, well, what's the weirdest, most general way the isoparametric inequality holds? And the famous example when people started thinking about this is Sierpinski's snowflake. I take an equilateral triangle and I put middle third equilateral triangles on each middle third. Then on each middle third here, I put little tiny equilateral triangles. And I'm thinking about the curve that goes around the outside of this thing. This thing's, as I do this over and over again, I get the Sierpinski snowflake. The area is clearly, it's inside a circle, so the area is finite. But this is a famous example where the perimeter, the length of the curve, goes to infinity. So as I do this more and more, the area stays finite. The perimeter goes to infinity. So the isoparametric inequality can get arbitrarily bad. And if I wanted to, I could smooth out these curves. And so I could get arbitrarily smooth things that had gigantic perimeter, and still the area would stay bounded. So there's no inequality going the other way at all, or no bounds in how bad it can get. But when you start, and this, the boundary of this thing would be some kind of curve. It'd be a continuous curve, but it wouldn't be a rectifiable curve. It doesn't have arc length, and in fact, it's one of those things that's going to be a nowhere differentiable function. This thing doesn't have a tangent vector to that curve at any spot. So when you start thinking about that, you'll get into some very interesting areas of, it's called geometric measure theory. And it's beautiful, well, it's a fantastic subject. It gets pretty involved in heavy use of real analysis. But as long as I stick to C2 curves, I would call this thing I gave you a proof. I believed it. After, it made me want to go read a proof of Green's theorem. But we proved all the basic tools that we needed in Fourier series to do it. And the rest is just monkeying around with algebra. Okay. If you have any questions about anything, Friday's the good day to ask, because the exam is in class here on Monday. I'm going to bring exam sheets and all the paper you need. So it's closed book and closed notes, so you won't need to bring anything but pencils and erasers.
It's an infinite dimensional subspace.